Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, and whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, join me as we explore the issues and ideas shaping our world with today's key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started. Sharp, relevant, and right to the heart of the story. It's Wednesday, the 11th of December. On our program today, I'll ask a top economist to look into his crystal ball for an economic outlook for 2025. Why medical aides are struggling to meet the needs of young professionals. The 2024 app of the year, and it wants to help learners succeed through technology. And we'll find out what the future of credit scoring actually looks like. Now, as 2024 draws to a close, the global and local economies are really at something of a crossroads, and I don't think that is an understatement. Both at home and internationally, there are significant challenges, but I would imagine also exciting opportunities, but also heightened risk. So to help us take a quick look back at the year that was and maybe what lies ahead for 2025 from a big macroeconomic perspective, I'm in conversation now with Kristy Viljoen, Senior Economist at PwC South Africa. Kristy, a very warm welcome. So, you know, we don't have that much time, but how much or how would you summarize the performance of the South African economy this year? Anything that really stood out for you?
Well, I'd say we probably had a tale of two halves. The first half of the year was very much a business as usual, except the end of load shedding, whether it's permanent or temporary. The second half of the year was, I think, filled with a lot more optimism. The financial markets, the confidence surveys, all of them show that South Africans are quite welcoming to this government of national unity. We've seen some tangible progress on the ground in certain areas by the new government. Still a long ways to go, but there's quite a lot of optimism that heading into 2025, this new government and what it could bring is creating a better business environment and a stronger economy for us all to live in.
Globally, what do you think the dominant economic forces were driving markets and growth and the significant impact on South Africa?
Well, this year, probably the dominant force wasn't economics, it was mostly politics. We had 50 countries go to vote. The majority of people in the world actually took part in an election this year. And a lot of the incumbents were replaced. Many of the presidents, prime ministers, etc., have been there for 4 or 5 years. And it's been quite a challenging period. It included COVID. It included the effects of the Ukraine-Russia conflict. So a lot of change in leadership. We think of the U.S., for example, which is getting a new president inaugurated in January and everything that could mean. So I'd say 2024 is probably the year of geopolitics and what that impacts on exchange rates, interest rates, commodity prices. That was, for me, probably the key driving force.
And uncertainty around big geopolitical issues, I would imagine, will still be key risks. And there's every likelihood that South Africa is going to be impacted one way or another.
Yes, I mean, we are a relatively small economy. We are amongst the top 30 in the world, but still, we don't have a big power in the world when it comes to economics and politics. We take the influence that these other big economies impact on us. So we think of the US, for example, the world's largest economy. It's getting a new president with all kinds of diverse ideas and not even consistency, or we're not exactly sure what the new president of the US is going to do on day one and day two. He's talking about implementing import tariffs on Canadian goods. Now, the Canadians have come and said, well, maybe we'll do the same. So, you know, those kinds of tit-for-tat politics could be a big issue. There's a bit of friction between the US and China about Taiwan. It makes for an interesting 2025, not necessarily good, but it's this geopolitics that keeps flowing. We've seen renewed uncertainty about the Middle East, which keeps building as the months go by. So maybe 2025 is again a year where geopolitics plays a big important part in what's happening in the global economy. And as South Africa, we can't control this. We can't have doors closed and say we're not interested in trading or investing with you or you. We need to take part in the global economy. So it's going to be for us sometimes a seesaw ride.
Talking of seesaw rides, there's no question that inflation and interest rates have been central to many discussions and decisions this year. How do you see these evolving locally and globally in the next 6 to 12 months?
So both local and global, that's one good news component that I think everyone's happy with. Our inflation rates have come down significantly, both in South Africa, developed economies, other emerging markets, as the worst of, I'd say, the 2022-23 shocks to commodity prices have evened out. We saw a response by central banks lifting interest rates, and that is also turning around. In South Africa, we've had two interest rate cuts. We expect another one or two to happen in the first half of next year, but that's one of the positive economic themes for 2025, at least the first half, is where globally we've got an easing in inflation pressures, we've got a decline in interest rates. So from a consumer perspective, that's great news. South Africa is, after all, still a consumer-driven economy. About 60% of our GDP is linked to consumer spending. So whenever you reduce interest rates, it makes it a little bit easier when it comes to the end of the month. Those debt repayments makes it a little bit easier on consumers and maybe frees up maybe a little bit more disposable income.
And another key economic theme next year will be companies and economies focusing on green initiatives and technology, and by that I mean AI-driven growth. I'm wondering to what extent South Africa, in your opinion, is positioned to leverage these trends.
Well, from an AI perspective, this possibility of what artificial intelligence and machine learning, all of those new tech tools, what that could mean for the productivity of workers, it's a great prospect. Many of our big companies, many of our forward-looking companies are already embracing it. But the challenge we have as a country is that we've got, in that sense, almost two economies. You've got big corporates with the latest tech, and then you've got a big chunk of the economy that is, I almost want to say, regular people going about their business that don't use this kind of tech in their production, in their economic activity. For them, doesn't really mean much, to be very honest. They might play around with a bit of AI on their smartphone, but it won't impact the way that the majority of South Africans go about their jobs. So yes, we'll still read about it very often, hear news stories about it, and what it could mean to make us more productive. But in the case of South Africa, where we've got such a large component of people that don't use it, and such a large component of labor employed in the informal economy, it's not something that's going to be massively impactful in 2025 at a macro level. At a company level could be, but at a macroeconomic level, it's not something that we're really, really looking at, to be honest.
And Christy, just a final one then. In your opinion, are there standout sectors or industries that you believe will drive local economic growth next year?
Well, again, we have to look at what's happening externally. If for some reason we can see a boom in commodity prices, we know mining will do better. Mining has been under a lot of pressure of late. And same thing for manufacturing, where there's a dependence on supply chains. If we can have a relatively quieter year from a geopolitical perspective, and that means that we have less disruption to supply chains, then we can think of mining and manufacturing, for example, as some of the more prominent and better opportunities for 2025. Depending on the weather, the same thing for agriculture. If our supply chain and our weather conditions are working out, then agriculture in terms of exports can also be a very strong industry. But again, we don't have control over many of these things. Many of these things are decided in capital cities around the world, and we'll just have to wait and see what the next big surprise for 2025 is going to be before we know what that means for South Africa.
Well, that is a very sharp crystal ball. Christy Viljoen, Senior Economist, PwC South Africa. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
As the demands on South Africa's professionals grow more complex, I guess so do their healthcare needs. And the debate around closed versus open medical schemes, I think, has never been more relevant, particularly for professionals who are navigating high-pressure careers. Often they are self-employed and, need I mention, rising healthcare costs. So let's pull all of that together. I'm in conversation with Craig Comrie, who is Chief Executive Officer of ProfMed. Craig, let's start with this. Why do you believe believe that the current healthcare system struggles to meet the unique needs of professionals. Where's the gap here?
Well, professionals and even the definition of the professional has changed in the last 5 to 10 years. I guess when you think of the professional, often even in our own medical scheme, we've thought of doctors and engineers and accountants and lawyers. In fact, that definition has changed significantly. Even those with those typical qualifications find themselves working in a different arena, doing business in many ways, actually running businesses that aren't always aligned to their professional qualifications. So we see emerging IT specialists that are hugely successful in terms of their own businesses that they run. And so as the professional definition has changed, so has the need to cover those young professionals in the industry. And so the issue of closed or open scheme becomes very relevant because the professionals move quite quickly. You have to design benefits that are relevant to these professionals and their changing needs.
Let's get a definition in just a moment of the difference between a closed and open scheme. But I notice you use the word young. Are we specifically referring to a younger cohort, or does this debate apply right across the age demographic?
Yeah, it is specifically to a young professional cohort. So typically in the ages of anything between, and we know young is some of the guys earning lots of money even at teenager stage, all the way through to probably 30-year-olds, and they're doing it differently. They're actually finding their qualifications a little bit differently, sometimes online, sometimes self-taught, and many are still going through the traditional qualification route, but heading into these young spaces in terms of how to use AI in their businesses, how to really get ahead in the world by balancing maybe two or three professions at a time.
And is the argument that the so-called open medical schemes are simply not addressing this?
Well, I think an open medical scheme has to provide medical scheme benefits for everybody, not just a professional cohort. So they have to actually look at the needs of the full population grouping rather than the specific niche group of professionals who think and manage their financial, even their healthcare affairs very differently. I mean, a wonderful example that we're aware of in the last 10 years is this growing trend that even though you may be living in South Africa, you're earning money from three or four different geographies in the world, depending on the business and the type of professional that you are. And so we see that these are young professionals that also are mobile. So they're working 3 months or 6 months in these different geographies only, and hopefully to return home being in South Africa. And so they're requiring things like travel cover for more than just the typical 30 or 60 or 90 days that have traditionally been offered in the open schemes, while in a scheme like ProfMed, you would get 180-day cover should you wish to travel overseas and still have the healthcare cover that you need.
And do you think, again, among that cohort, there is a lack of understanding in what they need and how to best access it? And if that's the case, how do you overcome it?
Yeah, the complexity of medical schemes has always been a problem, and it's a growing issue as we have different regulatory reforms in the country coming through, and probably the reforms aren't staying ahead of the pace of the needs of even the professional grouping. So trying to understand what you need is a really important part of getting the right cover. And it sounds like a typical insurance principle, but that's where healthcare insurance or medical schemes actually operate. And so understanding that need and driving flexible solutions on what you need then is a key part to dealing and being relevant to these professionals.
Aside from the flexibility, I would imagine that incentivization is also important when it comes to preventative care, particularly for professionals with demanding schedules. In other words, they've got to be rewarded for taking care of themselves.
Yeah, there's lots to be said, and we often comment about the importance of healthcare literacy, and that is understanding the cover, the healthcare cover that you need. And so it does move into this other bracket to say, well, what is the flexibility of what I need right now? But being aware of the preventative care benefits that you should access to invest in your health now. It sounds like an investment conversation to say you have to do some key investment activities now to earn the long-term rewards of happiness and longevity. And so these preventative care benefits effectively for many of the medical schemes, including our own, is being incentivized. So if you go for your age-appropriate health risk assessment so that we understand your BMI, whether you have family history of concerns, whether it's diabetes or other, we're incentivizing people to become more aware of these things, to change their behavior and invest in their health into the future.
Craig, a lot of people that you are targeting might not have a stable income. In other words, it's project-based work, so, you know, it's the feast and famine argument. How important is it to find that balance between affordability on the one hand, which could be moving up and down, and the comprehensive coverage, which is so critical, particularly in a high-stress environment?
Yeah, so it's another observation that we've made over the last few years. Is effectively, since the Credit Act came in, many individuals in general have not had access to credit, save these young professionals or older professionals who still have access. And so they've become more indebted as they went through COVID. And so the affordability of their medical scheme premiums has become a bigger and larger issue. It usually becomes either your second or third biggest expense after a mortgage or a vehicle is your medical scheme coverage. And so from an affordability level, it really is important that you don't just buy the most comprehensive medical scheme benefits, which there are in the market and they average over 10,000 rand a person, but that you can, if you are health literate, if you look carefully, sometimes use a broker if necessary, get to something that specifically addresses your current needs with a view of the future. And as you do that, you can go down to, and we offer an option for 1,022 rent, no co-payments for hospitalization, for a professional who is in the space where they don't have consistent income. So it's for a lower, typically what we would term a lower income bracket space. But it is, and if you do it properly, you can access significant reduced premiums, which makes it even more affordable than some of the health insurance products that are in place at the moment.
And just a final one, and I'm sure this is something that you are applying your mind to. In what way might the onset of NHI affect the closed system offering?
Yeah, so the NHI is set to affect all medical scheme members. And so together with the Industry Association, the Health Funders Association, we are opposing the NHI. We think it's a good idea as an intent perspective, but the mechanisms and the plan itself is the wrong way to get better access to healthcare for not only just those in the medical scheme space, but for the whole of South Africa. And so there are key aspects of that legislation that has to be challenged. Their constitutional rights that have to be challenged for those who access healthcare in a medical scheme space and those that don't. But the choice should always be available. So we are actively engaging in some of the challenges to the NHI, and we're hoping that together with the President and the Minister of Health, there'll be a more collaborative approach to how we can achieve better universal healthcare access in the future.
And I'm going to thank you for your time. That's Craig Comrie, who's the Chief Executive Officer of ProfMed. Appreciate your time, Craig. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's tech industry is celebrating its brightest stars at the 2024 FNB App of the Year Awards, and this year's top honor going to a concept called Matric Live. It's a groundbreaking educational app designed to transform how grade 10 through 12 learners engage with their studies. And I'm in conversation with the winner, Lesego Finger, who is a self-taught coder. Lesego, congratulations, first of all, on winning this prestigious award. So let's start with your inspiration. What was it and how did the idea take shape?
Thank you so much for having me. So yeah, like how the platform came about was, so just after I'd finished my matric, right, I'd realized kind of like the pitfalls of what I went through. where I was coming from a quintile 1 to 3 school, and majority of the time we would kind of share textbooks because, you know, each year we have to kind of like reuse textbooks, but some learners would never bring them back. So there would be a shortage of textbooks. And now you find that was kind of like a disadvantage whenever we had to kind of learn. So after finishing my matric, I was like, you know what, let me provide learners with the platform and provide them with the resources that I wish I had when I was doing my matric. So that was kind of like the initial concept around why I actually started the platform. Yeah.
So you're a self-taught coder, as I mentioned at the start of our conversation. What difficulties did you face in developing what appears to be a very sophisticated app, and how did you overcome those problems?
So while growing up, I was very naughty, and one of the things that my mother bought me was a laptop because she was trying to contain that naughtiness. And the first things I did, obviously, when you get a device, a new device, you obviously play games on them, right? And then at some point, I was like, you know what, let me try and study exactly how these games are made. So I went on YouTube and even Google, you know, and then I did a lot of research on that. And I was watching a lot of YouTube tutorials on how to actually build apps and games, you know, things like that. So that's kind of like how I got introduced to kind of like tech. But obviously, as you are going the unconventional route, you tend to, especially if you are learning fast, but also you are kind of not learning the more traditional route, meaning you don't maybe know the concept. So the difficulty is sometimes you are in a tech environment, you have built something, but you don't know certain terminologies because you've just went, you know, the kind of like the unconventional route. So also even like building my platform, you know, I didn't go like the traditional way, there was certain stuff that I had to learn as I was building the platform, you know. The first version of the platform was actually quite horrible. And, you know, there's a famous saying that if you are not embarrassed by the first version of a platform, then you have started off too late, right? But over time, it then started getting more advanced because of the skills that I would, you know, kind of like teach myself, but also most importantly, expanding my team, more people coming in who have more experience and then trying to basically make a better product.
So if I understand this, the Matric Live app offers features like gamified learning and also AI-driven academic support. So in your own words then, how do these elements improve the learning experience for students?
Yeah. So the platform Matric Live, by the way, it caters for grade 10 to 12 learners. It has over 12 plus subjects. So there's three elements that are involved on the platform. So you have learn, you have play, and then you have exam. With learn, this is where learners are consuming kind of like the content, right? And this could be your either through video, either through static content or even interactive content that we provide to learners. And then we also have an AI element that is involved whereby you can basically chat to an, I would say like an AI chatbot, but I don't like using the word chatbot because chatbots were quite dumb. But this one, we actually trained it around with our data so that it actually gives you content and explanations that are around the CAPS curriculum. And then we have the play side whereby you can basically challenge other learners, right? So this is where we add the gamification element where you can challenge other learners, get their points, end points, and then rank up a leaderboard. You know, one of the learners that is currently topping the charts now, you know, they're sitting at 100+ points. Trust me, this other one, Leonard, called me at night. Is like, I just want to know, is there another way to end points? Because I just saw some ridiculous points there. And yeah, it was actually a funny call. And then you have the exam simulation. So here we are trying to simulate the exam experience, right? So you find instead of just going through papers, you actually do the entire paper and then we tell you exactly where you went wrong. And this is not like a quiz, you know, where you select A or B. No, we're actually looking at real answers that you provide and then also using our AI models to decide if you're actually correct or not. So this works well with complex subjects like your maths, even like maybe content heavy subjects like even your history, things like that. So, yeah.
I don't need to point out the problems that we've got in secondary and tertiary education in South Africa. And it's fair to say, I think, that educational apps such as yours have the potential to bridge gaps in the system. So long or medium to long term, what impact are you hoping that Matric Live is going to have both on students and teachers?
Yeah. I think obviously on the long run, what we have been trying to do is to decentralize quality education, number one. Like I mentioned, there was a limit of resources, you know, especially where I was coming. But with this platform coming, you find now all of a sudden quality education is kind of decentralized in a way, you know, especially during COVID. If you remember, learners were stuck at home, parents were losing their jobs, and they needed an alternative in learning. So that's number one. And then another thing, obviously, even with teachers, you know, we have built actually a platform for them called Assessa, which is also kind of used outside of South Africa by the likes of your Kenya and stuff. But what we have built this platform is so that teachers know exactly where learners are struggling with. Because what you find is that sometimes we might label a learner bad in maths, but probably they're just bad in certain topics, right? And then that's where we need to strengthen support for them. So what we have also built is to make sure that we give teachers kind of data, more data-informed decisions, right? So I think those are the ones that I would say.
Just finally then, what is next for Matric Live? And I'm assuming that you already have plans to expand features and even reach other markets.
Yeah, no, definitely. By the way, Matric Life is just our flagship product. So there is a parent company called SAADC. I know it sounds like a party, but it actually stands for the Southern African Application Development Company. And that we are an edutech-based company that builds educational solutions, right? So the plan is for us to expand our impact and solution. You know, we want to be global players, especially within the African market. Like I mentioned, there's already a platform that we have built for teachers that have already started to scale outside of South Africa. So that's one of the things. We are continuously also improving our current platforms like your Matric Life. There's a new version that is coming out with more, you know, amazing features that also kind of embrace AI. You know, there's more stuff that we are doing in this space. So I think in a nutshell, that's kind of like more our ambitions. And yeah.
I wish you nothing but success in your future. Lesego Finger, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, access to credit is a gateway for economic empowerment. I think that's a truism. Yet many South Africans remain excluded from so-called traditional financial systems. And the future of inclusive credit scoring aims to bridge this gap by integrating alternative data, advanced technology, as well as financial literacy initiatives to create an equitable opportunity for underserved populations. What am I talking about? Well, from students to small business owners, rural communities, women facing financial barriers. The potential for innovation to transform access to credit is not only immense, but it's also important. And I want to get to grips with this issue. I'm in conversation now with Farhi Adams, who is Head of Credit Risk Solutions at TransUnion Africa. Farhi, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe the starting point for this conversation, and it is an important one. What is inclusive credit scoring, and why is it important within this particular economic ecosystem?
Hi, Jeremy. Well, inclusive credit scoring is something that we've been trying to solve for quite a while. So as you know, with traditional scoring, the factors that come into consideration are things like your payment behavior on your existing credit products. But what happens for someone that doesn't have any existing credit products, someone that's just recently, to your point, a student coming into the working world and wanting to apply for his first credit account? How do we cater for these guys? And that's where alternative data comes in. So what it typically does is, and there's various sources of alternative data, but it typically looks through a different lens at the client and tries to understand their behavior and also the credit worthiness. And what we typically do is we try and find sources of data that has some form of transactional or behavioral attributes to it that would give us a view of how this customer's potential to pay their accounts are.
There's surely less risk in the more conservative and traditional approach, though.
Fair enough, definitely there is, but how would we ever allow people that don't have any existing credit access into this market? Because what you need to understand is that people typically taking out loans are people that aren't necessarily using it for, they need it for funding personal reasons like paying their school fees, medical bills, but also people that are trying to start up micro businesses, right? So from your spaza shops, from your people that wanting to start food trucks, these guys need funding. And traditionally and generally, these people are economically active, but they're not necessarily active in your formal economy. Mm. So they are transacting, they are purchasing, they are selling, but none of this is seen by the bureau. So what we need to do is we need to tap into these alternative methods of transacting so that we can understand their behavior and also then do a call on their credit worthiness based on this. And just before we go further, it's interesting to note that we've recently done our Consumer Pulse survey, and we typically survey people that are active in the economy, and more than half of the respondents had indicated that should we include alternate data into our traditional scoring, if even for people that have accounts, they would get better scores. So there's definitely a need and an awareness of alternative data and the uses thereof.
And there is, as you're suggesting, a direct correlation between using better, more all-encompassing data and broader economic growth.
Definitely. So one of the biggest growth factors of the economy is your small to medium enterprises. And we really need to enable these guys and give them access to credit so that they can start these little micro economies, right? These little micro businesses, because it doesn't only impact them and their households, but as they grow, and a big portion of guys applying for finance are guys that want to expand their little micro businesses. In doing that, they're also creating more job opportunities so that we can tackle the unemployment problem that we've got in South Africa. So we find that, and we think that this is crucial to the South African economy. We need to be able to make credit more accessible to more people. But coupled with that, Jeremy, and just to kind of go on a bit of a tangent, just awarding credit to people is not enough. Financial literacy needs to go hand in hand as well, because what you'll be doing by just awarding people credit without educating them about credit and how to manage credit, you'll be doing exactly the opposite. Mm. Because if you're not explaining to them and teaching them how to make their monthly payments and they start defaulting on these accounts, automatically they won't have access to further credit. And in doing that, you'll then be financially excluding them. So what we're trying to do is to couple the access with the education to create long-lasting financial relationships, to put it in a very light way.
And let me pick you up on the access side, because your entire argument is correctly predicated on access to technology, which we still know is patchy in this country. So there will always be a wide net, surely, of exclusion.
Yeah, fair enough. And exactly to your point. So as much as credit education and credit financial access, digital access is big as well. But I mean, we're seeing that there's leaps and bounds in the development of your mobile networks and your internet to give us that reach. TransUnion develops the solutions to help us score and assess more accurately, right? But we can only really solve this thing through partnerships. Partnerships with the lenders, partnerships with government, partnerships with the regulators. But a big component of that is partnerships with our technology partners as well, in order to give us the reach and the access into your rural areas so that we can extend and reach these people to give them the access to the credit that they really require. A big problem and a big component of financial exclusion is the traditional brick and mortar network that we've got in South Africa. Lots of people can't get to your traditional banks to go and apply for financing. So what we typically see is your microfinances are setting up shop within the rural areas, because that's where the people are that require the access to finance. And this makes it easier for them to get this access they need, because the microfinances, finance lenders are right in their areas and in their communities.
So it's the bricks and mortar side of the equation, which I would imagine is still a problem. Why is there a slowness in terms of adaptation and pulling inclusive credits more into the mix?
I wouldn't say it's a problem, right? We'll always need our brick and mortar, right? Because a large portion of the population still wanted face-to-face contact, right? But I do believe that the future is going digital and getting that reach. And there's definitely been lots of development. I mean, our major banks, they're all going digital. Digital is a huge, huge factor in granting access. And if we just look at our neighbors in other countries, they don't have the infrastructure and the network in a brick and mortar fashion as we do. So what we find within some of the Africa countries is they've got a financial inclusion, same situation we do, but they've got better reach and a better digital network than we do, which allows them to have faster access to alternative sources of data, because more people are transacting on their cell phones via mobile wallets. In South Africa, we've got a very established brick and mortar formal banking economy, which kind of leaves us a bit behind in terms of our digital reach and our adoption of digital digital money, if you want to call it that.
As I said at the beginning of this conversation, critical then that that gap is bridged. Appreciate your time today. That's Fakhri Adams, who is Head of Credit Risk Solutions at TransUnion Africa. And just before I say goodbye, on our online poll today, what do you believe the biggest opportunity for South Africa is to boost its economy next year? Will it be green energy investment, empowering tech innovation, or unlocking inclusive credit systems? If you have a view on that, you can participate in the poll either on X or LinkedIn. And that is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening. And goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.